This is the Financial Sense News Hour. With the president of PFS Group, Jim Poplava. Since 1982, PFS Group has offered asset management and educational resources that have helped investors build, maintain, and preserve their wealth. Now, here's the Financial Sense News Team, Jim Poplava and John Loeffler.
Well, I hate to break bad news to all of you, but in reality, it's worse than it sounds. And I know you're going to ask me what it is I'm talking about. We'll let the audience do this, Jim. All right, audience, ask me what I'm talking about.
What are you talking about?
We're talking about Taxmageddon and the taxes that are going to hit us on January 1st, 2013 will provide a $7 trillion hit to the economy. It's literally like rushing over a fiscal cliff. It's going to hit us in four waves. We're going to go into this right here. And if we don't address this, our GDP will probably take around a 5% hit, and we will just be right back in a recession and worse, possibly a depression. At the level we're looking right now, unemployment could double. And above all, these taxes are going to provide a major hit to American families and especially middle and small businesses, which are the majority job providers in this country. Now, the unfortunate thing is that President Obama is not showing any leadership in this. And what we've been doing, you know, Jim, over the last few weeks, we've been looking at the patterns that the economy and the government and the Federal Reserve have traced since 2010. We seem to start the years off well. Things start to fall apart. And then they do a Hail Mary pass right in the last 6 weeks of the year to try to make everything recover so it bounces back up in January. But we've also got an election in November. The real problem is, regardless of what happens in November, these four waves of taxes are going to affect the economy, and they will happen on the watch of whomever is the next president. So we need to look at this. It's actually worse than you and I have discussed, because you've been doing some dissecting and looking at government figures.
Yeah, it's worse than being betrayed by the media. In fact, the media is almost silent on this very issue because they don't want to talk about it, especially ahead of a presidential election. The CBO assumes that the giant tax increases are going to bring in the revenues. And what we have shown historically, and this has been shown empirically by professors on liberals, conservatives, is that history shows no matter what the tax rates are, revenues, tax revenues are never more than between 18 and 20% GDP. You could raise tax rates to 90%, you're still going to get no more than 20% of GDP. This also assumes, when the CBO is taking a look at this, it also assumes what is called static accounting, meaning that if you do raise taxes, that if you, let's just take an example, if you have a $1 million economy and the tax rates are 35%, you take in $350,000. You raise the tax rates to 48%, you take $480,000 in. But that doesn't take into account what happens to economic activity. A good example is, take a look at Greece. They raise taxes, and we'll get into this in another segment of the economy. Everywhere that they've raised taxes in Europe, tax revenues have fallen, and GDP has fallen as well. They've gone in. Greece is actually in a depression right now. And it's not just Europe. You can take a look at my own state of California. We've raised taxes several times, and tax revenues have fallen in this state 3 years in a row. And what are we doing? We're going to raise taxes by another 30%, or actually 40% when you take a look that they're going to lower the brackets on which they assess the taxes. Tax revenues have been falling, and that's why we started out the year with a $9 billion budget deficit. It now turns out to be $16 billion because expenses have gone up and tax revenues have fallen off a cliff.
You know, you would never know what you were just saying is true if you listened to the pundits, especially on the left side of the equation, because they keep talking as if we just keep taxing the rich a little more, you know, the fair share argument, everything would be okay. And you know that's not true. And what you're trying to say here is that as you raise the tax rates, there are compensations that happen in the economy. In other words, there's either fraud, flight, or fight. It also damages the economy, so revenues are lower. Businesses make less, pay less income tax. And so no matter how high you ratchet that thing up, it's still not going to gain any more tax than about 20% of GDP. Now, before we went on the air, and this surprised me. I mean, when we started to plan this program and you laid out wave after wave of taxes, I went, oh, dear, this is worse than I thought it was going to be. Let's divide them up. We'll take wave number one here.
Okay, let's begin with wave number one, which is the expiration of the 2001 and the 2003 Tax Relief Acts under President Bush. I mean, some of the obvious things, the top tax rate goes from 35 to 39.6. The lowest rate will rise from 10 to 15%. All rates in between will rise. Itemized deductions and personal exemptions will be phased out again, which is the equivalent of raising tax rates. But let's begin with some of the obvious ones in the first wave of taxation. There's going to be four of them that are going to take place. The 10% tax bracket disappears and the lowest tax bracket goes to 15%. So if you're in a 10% tax bracket, remember the first level of income, we have a progressive rate structure. So the first level of income is taxed at 10%, then that is going to disappear. The lowest tax rate will be 15. So the 10% bracket goes up to 15%. That's really going to hit lower income groups because you're talking about a 50% increase in the tax rate. The 25% tax bracket rises to 28%. So there's a 3%. The 28% bracket then rises to 31%. That's another 3% tax rate. The 33% bracket rises to 36%. And the 35% bracket rises to 39.6. So at the lowest bracket, at 10%, that bracket goes up to 50%. And then from 25 to 33%, each one of those three tax brackets in between all go up three full percentage points. And the top end tax bracket goes up by 4.6 percentage points. So that's the first thing that happens. The second thing is if you are married, the marriage penalty comes back. One of the things the Bush tax cut fixed is they got rid of the marriage penalty. If you were married, you actually paid a higher tax bracket is if you and your wife got divorced and filed as single taxpayers. So the marriage penalty comes back. That'll probably cost the average family another $2,000 or $3,000 in taxes if you're married. The child tax credit will be cut in half from $1,000 to $500 per child. And the standard deduction will no longer be doubled for married couples relative to a single level individual. That's what happened is to get rid of the marriage tax penalty is they doubled the standard deduction. In addition to that, the middle class death tax comes back. The estate tax bracket goes from 35% to 55%, and the exemption falls from $5 million down to $1 million. So the estate tax rates go up by 60%, and the exemption that you can pass on tax-free drops by 80%. The next thing, for investors, the capital gains tax will rise from 15% to 23.8%, and the tax on dividends will go from 15% to 43.4%. So this is the first wave of tax increases.
You know, all I can think of when they're doing this is, what are they thinking? I mean, can you see some husband saying to his wife, well, dear, the rates are going up next year, so I'm out of here. Heart attack. Thud. At least she gets to make use of the estate tax this year, right?
Or the other thing is, you know what, honey? In order to maintain our lifestyle, we're going to have to live together as a couple but file as a divorce. Because that would be, if you're married, one way to get rid of the marriage tax penalty would be to get divorced and still keep the family together. I mean, it's just absolutely crazy.
How much of this is due to repeal of previous tax cuts? We had tax cuts in 2001 and 2010. And how much is new tax out of that whole panoply that you listed?
This first wave is the repeal of the Bush 2001 and 2003 tax cuts. And actually, in this first wave is also the repeal of the payroll reduction. Social Security taxes, tax withholding, were cut by a third. So instead of paying 7.65 on your first 108 or 110,000, it drops to 4.65. So Social Security taxes dropped by a full 2 percentage points, meaning if you make $100,000, you're paying $2,000 less in Social Security. So that also ends January 1st.
Okay, so now we move on to wave number two, and we've already been talking about the fact that the Supreme Court's expected to have a decision on the constitutionality of part or all of Obamacare on about June 25th, which is about 9 days from the Saturday the show first airs. But some of the provisions are already being implemented this year. Insurance companies are having to pay for things, yada, yada, yada. Now, the real question is, if it's found unconstitutional, how are you going to untangle what's already been started?
They would put a halt to it. I mean, some of the effects that have already gone into effect, there is a tanning tax. So if you go to a tanning salon, that's already in effect. There's a medicine cabinet tax on drugs. There's an HSA withdrawal tax. There's the W-2 health insurance reporting requirement. So these have already gone into effect. Now, what I'm going to talk about here are those things that go into effect January 1st, 2013. The first of these is the Medicare payroll tax is going to go up by 0.9%. It's going to go from 2.9% to 3.8%. So why don't we just round it off? Instead of paying 3% Medicare tax, you're going to pay 4% Medicare tax. It also imposes a cap on FSAs of $2,500. Now it's unlimited. There are a couple things that are going to happen. The medical device tax is going to go into effect. Medical device manufacturers, everything from heart valves. This is an industry that employs almost 500,000 people and 6,000 plants around the country. The law imposes a 2.3% excise tax on any medical device that's made, so that's going to raise costs. In addition to that, if you are deducting, and especially for families that have an illness, let's say one spouse is pretty sick, is the ability to deduct your itemized deductions is going to limit. Currently, those individuals who are facing high medical expenses are allowed a deduction for their medical expenses to the extent that the expenses exceed 7.5% of your adjusted gross income. So let me just make a simple illustration. Let's assume that your taxable adjusted gross income is $100,000. If your medical expenses exceed 7.5%, in this case $7,500, anything over the $7,500, you would actually be able to deduct against your taxable income. Beginning next year, the threshold increases from 7.5% of your adjusted gross income to 10%. Of your adjusted gross income. So these are the new medical devices. And then, of course, we have the investment tax of 3.8%. That 3.8% will be added to capital gains, bringing the capital gains tax rate to 23.8. It will be added to the top tax bracket of 39.6, bringing the top tax bracket to 43.4. And that's the tax on dividends. If you own rental property, you will pay an additional 3.8% surtax on your net rental income. That means taxable rental income. If you have an annuity or a pension annuity payout, you will pay an additional 3.8% on that annuity tax. If you're earning interest on a bank CD, you're also going to pay 3.8% tax on your interest that you're earning at the bank or any kind of bond.
Well, I guess after all of this, remember President Obama the first time during his first election campaign ran on hope and change. I think we're left without hope here and only change in our pockets when this is done. I keep thinking, what are they thinking of? You know, what is Congress thinking of with this whole thing? All right, wave number three. Go ahead, wave number three.
Okay, so those are the first two waves. Wave number one, the repeal of the Bush tax cuts. Wave number two, Obama's healthcare taxes. Wave number three, the raising of the alternative minimum tax and employer tax hikes. When Americans file their tax returns in January 2013, there are going to be a lot of nasty surprises that they're going to face with. And at the top of the list is the alternative minimum tax. There will be no extension unless it's extended or relieved. This could ensnare 31 million Americans, up from 4 million last year. Congress's failure to increase this is basically, John, I forget how many taxpayers, but this will affect probably about 31 million taxpayers. And what the alternative minimum tax does is you take all of your taxable income, whether it's salary income, gross income, interest from rents, dividends, investments, capital gains, whatever, and then you deduct, let's say you have a lot of itemized deductions. You have your state tax deduction, you have your mortgage interest deduction, you have your charitable contributions, you have your medical expense, you know, your itemized deductions. Well, if you have a lot of those, if it reduces your taxable income, your tax accountant has to do two calculations. What is your taxes due after all your itemized deductions? And then they compute a separate tax, which is the alternative minimum tax. It's a special tax rate that they do. And basically, it gets rid of your itemized deductions and a lot of your exemptions and tax-free income. And it computes a tax. And what happens is, then the two taxes are compared. And if the alternative minimum tax is higher than your regular income tax, you pay the difference. Let's say that on $100,000 income, your income taxes are $25,000, but the alternative minimum tax is $28,000, then what would happen is you would have to pay an additional $3,000 in AMT tax when you file your tax return. So that is something that goes into effect January 1st.
Yeah, it's important to point out to people that the original purpose of the alternative minimum tax was to make sure that rich people, here's this rich people argument again, who had managed to structure everything in such a way as to avoid, legally, not evade, paying tax, vis-a-vis, say, for example, Warren Buffett, they would have to pay at least some tax. The problem is that as the in dollar has been inflating and the price of everything moving up, and then, of course, income does move up with it, now suddenly a whole bunch of people in the middle class that were not paying alternative minimum tax are now being snagged by this tax that originally was supposed to just hit the wealthy. So that's the background of that tax.
Yeah, and then an additional tax is going to go into effect is there right now, if you're a small business, you can expense half of the purchases of equipment. Let's say you buy a Xerox machine, I don't know, you buy some press for your manufacturing plant, you get to write off almost half of what you spend on that equipment in the year you purchase it. So if you buy $10,000 worth of equipment, you can write off, I think it's up to like $25,000 or $30,000. That goes away next year. Taxes are also going to be raised on businesses. One of the biggest ones is the loss of the research and the R&D experimentation tax credit. So if you're an entrepreneurial company and you're doing R&D research, whether it's drugs, whether it's new kinds of trying to come up with a new manufacturing process, that goes away. Tax benefits for education and teaching are going to be reduced. The deduction for tuition and fees will not be available. Tax credits for education will be limited. Teachers will no longer be able to deduct classroom expenses, and the education savings account will be cut. Employer-provided educational assistance to employees, like, you know, we have an education program for all our employees. The deduction for that will end. Student loan interest deductions will be disallowed for literally millions of American families. And the charitable contributions from IRAs will no longer be allowed. Under the current law, a retired person with an IRA can contribute up to $100,000 per year directly from their IRA to a charity. This contribution counts towards the required minimum distribution. That also goes away. So those are the first three waves that are going to take effect January 1st, and that's why they're calling it Taxageddon, because, I mean, this is going to hit the economy like Herbert Hoover in 1932 when he raised tax rates to 25, from 25% to 63, and he literally plunged the country into the depths of the Great Depression.
I'm afraid to ask, but let's do the fourth wave. I'm wondering if this is going to get any worse, and I'm wondering why there's no yell and scream about this right now.
for election purposes. The president wants these in effect, and they're bearing this because this is a major, major issue. And it's an issue that the president has been ducking. I mean, we've been kicking the can down the road for 2 years. And this is an election year, and the president needs to appeal to his base. And in the middle of an election year, and this also goes for Republicans, nobody wants to deal with it. Now, there are some people. There are a growing list of Democrats that are working together. Paul Ryan, Ron Wyden, a Democrat from Oregon, are saying, look, this thing is going to hit January 1st. It is so big that we need to address this, not another Hail Mary play. So there's two ways to address this, John. The best way right now, given that the White House could change, the makeup of Congress could change, is let's postpone this for another year so that the new president, if it's Obama, gets reelected, or it's Romney, can sit there with the new Congress, and instead of the last minute before Christmas holidays, come up with a last minute proposal in a patch job, really address this. Because on top of that, and we don't have time to cover this, is the new CBO report that just came out in the last 2 weeks on the long-term budget deficit projections. I just did an interview with John Williams that will be featured on our premium site, where the government's net present value of future liabilities is $100 trillion. And that's under Treasury GAAP reporting. And the CBO just published a new budget deficit, and the numbers are quite frightening. So it's an issue that we've been kicking the can down the road, and you want to see what happens when you do that is just take a look at what's going on with Greece. We will cover that in another topic in the big picture today. As I mentioned, this is an extended edition because there are just so many things that are critical that are going to hit the news waves this weekend, next week, and the week after. But in the fourth wave, I've got a copy here, and we just don't have time to cover in this segment. It's a 46-page document. It's called A List of Expiring Federal Tax Deductions from 2009 to 2020. It was prepared by the staff on the Joint Committee on Taxation. Let's just put it this way. It is 46 pages of various tax deductions for businesses and individuals that are going to expire in the next 3 years. So a big wave. Let me just go here to 2013. This is just unreal, folks. If you look at this, 2013, we've got four full pages of tax deductions that are expiring next year. And I've got five pages of tax deductions that expire at the end of this year. So, I mean, we don't have time to cover 46 pages of business tax deductions that expire. It's probably the reason why you have seen a pullback by corporations sitting on the sidelines with over $2 trillion with tax, because they know at the end of this year, these 46 pages of deductions are going to be expiring this year, next year, and the year after. We know all these first three waves that we talked about in this segment are coming due. So, John, that's why they're calling it Taxmageddon. And it's amazing the media is keeping silent on this, or what we refer to in the media business, they're spiking this, or in other words, they don't want to talk about it and discuss it because they don't want the American people to know about it.
Yeah, and the reason is, just so people understand, spiking a story as opposed to spinning a story, spiking is not covering a story when you know the story merits covering, that there's a real story there, you just don't do it. And usually that's done because the media, well, they like Obama and they don't want to cast a negative light. And if people thought they were about to be hit with this giant panoply of taxes, which has been mounted upon them, they're not going to broadcast that. That's what's going to happen. And so that's what you're finding right now. And that's why the story is being spiked. And what's interesting is, remember, whoever gets elected president, if President Obama is reelected or Governor Romney is elected, when we go off this cliff and the train wreck we've been discussing for a number of years here on the program, that's all going to happen during the tenure of the next president. So he will be blamed for whatever happens. They won't notice the fact that, I don't know, maybe Governor Romney will start in, you know, I inherited this mess. Well, you know,
hey, it's worked for the president for 4 years, so maybe it'll work for the next president.
Yeah, but maybe if there's enough, how would we describe it? Maybe if there's enough feedback on this and people begin to realize what's happening, that something has to happen, then there may be some action between now and the election or the end of the year. Let's face it, we're still just in June right now. So there's 6 months to go. A lot can happen in June.
You're listening to the Financial Sense NewsHour at financialsense.com.
Tax reform. I want to see lower tax rates. It makes no sense to me that we have the highest corporate tax rate in the world. I know what that will do. I've been in business. I know that over time, at the margin, slowly but surely, enterprises will move to places that have lower taxes. Or you'll recognize your income in places that have lower taxes. And I know the IRS will go after you and try and make you recognize it back here, but ultimately, over time, just like water flows to the lowest point, profits will flow to the place where the taxes are lowest. And so I want to get the tax rate down to at least 25% and do that in the anticipation of not losing revenues. I'm not expecting you're going to pay overall less tax. I just want to make this a more attractive place from a tax standpoint. Less complexity, simplify the tax code, get our tax rates down competitive with other nations on an individual level. I don't want to raise the individual marginal tax rate from 35 to 40%. I know there are some who think that that's a great way to go after rich people. And first of all, shame on anybody who thinks we're going to divide the country based on success.
Having examined the Greek elections this weekend, following right on the heels of that will be the Fed's Open Market Committee, and they are meeting on Tuesday and Wednesday. The markets are holding their breath because they want to know, is there going to be quantitative easing or no quantitative easing? And of course, this would be QE3, no reference to the ship, the QE2.
Okay. Well, you know, John, there are a number of indicators, one that Bloomberg uses, and then one that various other financial organizations use. And the odds of QE have now increased to 30%. I imagine by the time we get the June unemployment report, which will be the first week of July, thank goodness it's on a holiday weekend because it's probably not going to be good news, that the odds will increase to 50%. But the odds are increasing because of two factors. Number one, a key person, a vice chairman of the Fed, Janet Yellen, says she wants QE, and she gave a very important speech. And then two, inflationary expectations are basically declining. In other words, people are looking at inflation rates 5 years out, 10 years out, and those inflationary expectations keep falling. The lower they fall, the more likely that we're going to get some form of quantitative easing. We just don't know what kind of shape that will turn out to be. In other words, what kind of program. It'll be unconventional, I'm sure, because we're already down to 0% interest rates. But Janet Yellen is a key person. I mean, she's a vice chairman of the Federal Reserve, and she argued in a speech she gave recently that the Fed could tolerate a higher inflation rate above its official target rate of about 2% if it meant that growth would accelerate and the unemployment would fall. And she gave a speech, and she had three graphs in her presentation. And this is something we're eventually going to start showing to our premium members, because we'll be showing the graphs, the tables, and things that we use in the big picture. So unfortunately, I can't share this with you, but there's something called the Taylor Rule, which takes a look at weighs the inflation mandate more heavily than the employment mandate. And if you take a look at where inflation rates are right now, if we were using the Taylor Rule, it would say that the Fed should immediately begin raising interest rates. Well, if you take a look at the last 2 years, the Fed has ignored the Taylor Rule because they feel that they needed a more balanced approach, especially given the high levels of unemployment in this country that remain at almost depression levels. Because remember, it was just a little over a year ago, the unemployment rate was at over 10%. The U6 figure is 14.6%. Then she presented another graph, which was a balanced approach that overweighs the social cost of inflation versus the social cost of unemployment. And basically what the Fed is saying here is we can tolerate a higher inflation rate if it brings down the unemployment rate. And if you look at that, the rules especially would argue instead of 2014, the Fed, under its new, the graph that she presented in her speech, argues that they extend 0% interest rates from 2014 to 2015. In other words, extend it out another year. And the reason for that is inflation has been coming down and unemployment remains stubbornly high. And if you look at the gist of this, it basically is arguing that they keep interest rates at zero to 2015. Now, what is very important here is the second part of Yellen's argument or reason for QE is, as we said, there's the likelihood of QE is due to a number of reasons. Number one, Janet Yellen's speech arguing for it. And number two, inflationary expectations. And if you look at the inflationary expectations, for example, the 10-year TIPS, they're still above 2%, but they're heading down. And the minute that they fall below 2%, we've always seen quantitative easing in the past. 5-year inflationary expectations are at 1.5%. They're just slightly above 1.5%. But anytime 5-year inflationary expectations head below 1.5%, every time 10-year inflationary expectations head below 2%, we have had quantitative easing in every instance, whether it was in March of 2009, whether it was in November in 2010, whether it was in September or October of 2011 when we had Operation Twist. So given where inflationary expectations are heading down, it would argue that by the July 31st to August 1st meeting, the Fed will launch QE3. And what we're likely to see next week, I mean, there's no reason right now to launch a quantitative easing to bring down Treasury yields because Treasury yields have fallen from 2.38% a couple months ago to in 3 months. And here's very important. Right now, Treasury yields on 10-year Treasuries are 1.57. From their peak 3 months ago, Treasury yields have fallen in a three-month period by 70%. So basically, the stock market, as a result of the safety trade, is already doing the Fed's job. Usually when they announce these purchases of, you know, $1 trillion, $1.2 trillion of treasuries, as they did with QE1, or $600 billion of treasuries in QE2, it was to bring down interest rates. Well, the market's already done that. So that's probably not likely to happen unless interest rates start to spike out during the fiscal cliff debate that will probably start in around August. So what is more likely to happen in this next meeting next week is they are likely to change the language saying risk to the downside have increased. We stand ready to operate. Things are worsened. We're concerned about the employment and we stand ready to act. So it's basically telling the market, look, we know things are heading down. And if we look at some of this week's economic data that came out, the economy is worsening. The Manpower Outlook Survey declined. The good news for the Fed, and this gets down to the inflationary expectations, import and export prices have dropped in the month of May as the dollar has risen. We have the Producer Price Index dropped in the month of May. However, this is one that's got the Fed concerned. Retail sales have now dropped 2 consecutive months in a row. They're negative, the first time that we've seen that since November of last year. We have jobless claims are rising again. Last month, the unemployment rate went up to 8.2%. We created fewer jobs, so that trend is worsening. The consumer price index fell, so that once again goes along with inflationary expectations. According to Realty Track, home foreclosure activity rose 9% in May. So we're starting to see the financial stress index credit spreads are widening. meaning that credit outside of treasuries is starting to go up. And as a result, foreclosures, we had the New York Empire State Manufacturing Index came out. In New York, it fell to 2.3% in June from 17.1 in May. So the New York Empire State Manufacturing Index is about ready to go negative. Industrial production fell to 0.1% in May. That has been heading down since probably November last year. The University of Michigan Consumer Sentiment Survey has fallen from 77.5 to 76.5. And the ECRI weekly index actually went up a little bit from 121.3 to 121.9, but that could also be revised. And the annualized index is up slightly. So the trend on the economic front is for lower economic growth and higher unemployment. So this is not a good thing. So what we would expect to happen, unless the crisis in Europe just blows up as a result of Sunday, is the most likely thing is they will change the language to indicate things have worsened, the risk to the downside have increased, and we stand ready to act. And then if we get the June numbers continue in the trend that we're seeing every single week now, with the LEIs rolling over, the coincident indicators heading down, and the lagging indicators starting to turn over and head down, as the economy worsens over the next 30 days, and especially worsening heading into the end of the summer, that the Fed would react probably at the July 31st and August 1st meeting with some kind of either operation twist or they start buying home mortgages. And, of course, all of that precludes some kind of disaster coming out of Europe. If some kind of disaster comes out of Europe, then you could see widespread coordinated intervention between the Bank of England, the ECB, the Fed, and the Bank of Japan, or maybe even the Swiss Bank and other central banks, pretty much like we did last November.
You're listening to the Financial Sense NewsHour at financialsense.com.
Anybody tell you that the challenges we face right now are beyond our ability to solve? You know, it's hard not to get cynical when times are tough. And I'm reminded every day of just how tough things are for too many Americans. Every day I hear from folks who are out of work or have lost their home. Across this country, I meet people who are struggling to pay their bills, or older workers worried about retirement, or young people who are underemployed and burdened with debt. I hear their voices when I wake up in the morning, and those voices ring in my head when I lay down to sleep. And in those voices, I hear the echo of my own family struggles as I was growing up, and Michelle's family struggles when she was growing up, and the fears and the dashed hopes that our parents and grandparents had to confront. But you know what? In those voices, I also hear a stubborn hope and a fierce pride and a determination to overcome whatever challenges we face.
You know, different age groups have always talked about the other age groups, like older age groups say, whatever are these younger people doing? However will they get on in the world? We've heard that for years and years and years. What is interesting now is the different age groups in regards to the presidential elections and how they get their information, whether it's on radio and television or on the internet or on, more specifically, on some of the social media. And there are some pretty stiff walls that exist between all of these areas. And the question is going to be how the presidential candidates will use this in the upcoming election. And Bloomberg did a 25-page story on the influence of Steve Jobs, who is now deceased, of course, and Steven Spielberg on the Obama campaign. I know, Jim, you're also reading Joe Klein's book, Amateur, which portrays President Obama as a brilliant politician. He's really good at saying the right things and getting elected, and just very much like a community organizer, but somewhat incompetent as a leader. At least that's the portrayal in Klein's book. And the real question is now, if you look at a lot of the failures of the Obama administration, which the left media tries to ignore and the right media try to emphasize, nevertheless, the real question is going to be, how is this going to be portrayed as we really get down to the bottom of silly season when we get close to the election? And what kind of a system will the president use in order to achieve re-election?
This was really a fascinating topic. And if you read the biography of Steve Jobs by Isaacson, he talks about when Obama met Steve Jobs in 2010 and Jobs' advice to Obama if he wanted to get reelected. And this goes beyond that, because as you just mentioned, there's a book out called Amateur, which is right at the top of the New York Times best-selling list by Joe Klein. And it really portrays the president as a brilliant politician. I mean, here's a guy that defeated the Clinton political machine and was very effective in doing so because, you know, the Clintons were just taken by surprise. Who is this guy? And he came out of nowhere and became president. So, I mean, when you talk about political brilliance, he is probably one of the most brilliant politicians that we've seen. But then, as Klein talks about in his book and others have written books as well, but when it comes to governing, he's incompetent. And so this begins with the story. There's a guy by the name of Jim Messina, and he is currently the White House Deputy Chief of Staff. President Obama was on vacation in January 2011. They were sitting on the beach in Honolulu, and he was asking Jim Messina, and he said, you know, would you consider heading up my reelection campaign? And Messina turns to the president. He said, "What? The only way I'd do that is if you allow me to run the campaign the way I want to run it." And the president said to Messina, and he goes, "Well, you know, what's wrong with the way we ran it in 2008? You know, it worked. I'm here as president." And he said, "Yeah, but we didn't have your track record back then." So he was saying, you know, take a look at your track record. Unemployment's up. The deficits have exploded. Anemic economic growth. We've got to overcome that. And so the president agreed. And in January of 2011, Jim Messina began a road trip in California, meeting with all of the high-tech executives who are in the Democratic camp. He met with Steve Jobs at Apple. Steve was still alive at that time. He met with Mark Zuckerberg at Facebook, the head of Zynga. He met with Ed Schmidt at Google, met with the Microsoft people and Salesforce.com, and also met with Steven Spielberg at DreamWorks. And Steve Jobs tore into Messina for everything the White House was doing wrong and what it ought to be doing differently, and what Jobs was telling the president. He goes, look, he said, last time you were programming only to a couple of channels, the web, email, television, and radio. And I mean, I don't need to tell you, if you live in Wisconsin, you just went through a barrage of not only computer telephone calls, advertisements on radio, advertisements on television, and flyers in the mail. That's typically the channels that most political consultants will advise their clients. And what Jobs was talking about, look, the American public is now segmented into different age groups, into different methods of how to reach them. And he talked about, you need to expand your horizon to a variety. You need to be talking about Facebook. You need to be talking about Tumblr, Twitter, YouTube, Google. And also, mobile technology is going to be central to the campaign. And then they talked to Spielberg, and Spielberg, you know, what is Hollywood? Hollywood is all about creating illusions. And so DreamWorks is going to be behind creating a lot of the Obama commercials. They're going to be doing like a documentary. They're going to be doing the television commercials, and they're going to create this illusion of somebody who is different than who he actually is, but that's what Hollywood's about. On the opposite side, you've got somebody that's very competent in terms of creating jobs, being a businessman, a successful business person, which is Romney. And Romney, at least at this point, is probably going to have, probably use the more traditional outlets. And what Romney's got going for him is President Obama's track record, which is what Messina was basically telling the president. He goes, look, we got to overcome your track record. It's terrible. So we got to get the voters focusing in the opposite direction. And for the first time, John, you actually have the technology. They brought in high-tech programmers from Silicon Valley that have programmed something called the Dashboard, which is an in-house program. They scrapped all the typical political consultants. And in order to expand the universe of potential supporters, the Obama team spent 9 months building a computer software program it calls Dashboard, which allows field staffers and volunteers to access and update the campaign's voter database from an app on their phones. So it's really going to be technology versus competence. And the only thing that can stop this is either huge gaffes made by Romney, because the Obama camp has got the major networks behind it. They've got the major newspapers. 90% of the media is in the Obama camp. And so on the one side, you've got technology and the government media versus, let's say, Obama's track record.
I think what we're seeing here is the emergence of a new set of methodology in waging presidential campaigns that are relying, first of all, on the new technology and other factors, which may or may not have anything to do with whether the gentleman or lady is qualified for the office.
Yeah, because what you're going to do is one of the things that Spielberg, when he came back and he synthesized it for the president after touring Silicon Valley and Hollywood, is he said, look, Mr. President, we need to do three things. We need to raise a ton of money because this is going to be costly. Two, register voters. Three, persuade voters and create an illusion. And if we can do those three things, barring an unforeseen event or a turn in the economy, because we're not going to focus on your track record and what track record you do have, we're going to have to recreate it and create the illusion. And you need to do those three things. So it boils down to a key set of voters that are going to decide the election, and all the technology, money, and management theory, what we've got to do is we have to discredit your opponent and re-image and recreate you despite your track record. So it's all about illusion.
We know that the country is, for the most part, relatively evenly split between Democrats and Republicans. It's a little above 40%, probably about 43% Democratic, 35 to 38% Republican. And so what really counts now in these elections is this little tug of war over the swing vote. And now into the swing vote, you have some undecideds that may be members of those two parties, libertarians, some constitutionalist groups, Tea Party groups, possibly even the Occupy Wall Street crowd. But I think they tend to be more in the Democratic camp, but I'm not sure. But that's the swing vote is what's deciding everything.
Yeah, and it's why the president gave his speech on Friday that he's bypassing Congress through executive decision so to grant amnesty for a lot of illegal people that are in this country because he needs that vote. And that's going to be key. Now, Messina is going to focus the president's campaign on seven states. Seven states are going to decide this election: Florida, Ohio, Virginia, Iowa, North Carolina, Colorado, and Nevada. And so with a lot of illegals in this state, it's going to be key for Arizona, Florida, Colorado, Nevada are key states there. So, but anyway, the key undecided states, that's where they're going to focus the campaign.
This type of thing was really critical in the campaigns between what later became President George Bush and Vice President Al Gore in the early part of this century.
Yeah, and what is really key here is you're really centering it on, and because that's what it is. I mean, if you're basically Republican, you're probably going to vote Republican. If you're Democrat, you're going to vote Democratic. And most presidential campaigns center around the undecided, and they have this down to a science. They know the percentage of independents in these states, and so we have this background story that they know where the undecideds are, they know where the key swing states that they need to win the election, and that's why you're seeing, for example, already Steven Spielberg is behind a website called RomneyEconomics.com, which portrays Romney as a horror story when it comes to governing as he did in Massachusetts or his successful careers Bain Capital. Remember, you got to destroy your opponent's character because you can't run on your track record because it's terrible. And so what you've got to do is you got to reconfigure who you are. So they're going to create this illusion now, because that was the one thing that Messina was telling the president. Look, we can't run on hope and change. People have seen what you've done for 4 years. That isn't going to work this time. We have to create the illusion of who you are. And we also have to take down Romney's character and create doubt in the mind of the independents of who Romney is. And it's all going to be done with technology. It's going to be done with film, fantasy, and Hollywood.
Well, right now, he has not been able to raise the amount of money that I think he thought he would. I think he wanted something like $1 billion. There are some groups that are alienated, but what he's relying on is Hollywood for his support base, and also to present this whole image that we're talking about, along with a whole series of special interest groups, environmentalists, and others.
Yeah, and I mean, this election is probably one of the most key and pivotal elections in U.S. history, going back to probably the Great Depression, John, because it's really a contest between two different versions of government and between competing ideas on how to reach voters. And you've got these two competing visions of government. You've got one that is more free market, freedom oriented, and then you have sort of the European model, which Obama gravitates to. And then it's also a competing version in terms of the way traditional campaigns are run, with heavy use of television advertising backed by a massive war chest, and Messina's vision of using technology. And what Messina is counting on, he can use technology to mitigate Obama's disadvantages of the way he's governed the country. So that's why Messina has got technology's biggest titans. I mean, he's got Google, Facebook, Zynga, Salesforce.com, Microsoft, DreamWorks, SKG. So you've got technology titans, and you've got the more traditional campaign. So that's what's going to make this presidential campaign fascinating. It's not just going to be about who's got a better version. It's not just about the different visions of where the country needs to go, whether we're going to go the route of Europe or we're going to go the more traditional free market route that America has always done. I mean, that's why America is doing much better than Europe right now. Europe's a mess, but nonetheless, that's where the president wants to take us, is more the European route, big government, big corporations, big government solutions where the government decides who wins, who loses, versus more of a free market. So you throw technology into it, it's going to be a fascinating race. But once again, probably one of the most pivotal races in American history.
Well, but it looks pretty good for President Obama, I would think. The president has Hollywood, Silicon Valley, environmental groups, especially environmental groups, public employee unions, trial lawyers, they're all backing him. So is there something that could go wrong in this?
Yeah, it's what Messina told the president, the economy. You know, I mean, if you look at the trend, the LEIs are rolling over, the coincident economic indicators are rolling over, the unemployment rate is going back up. If the U.S. economy tanks or sinks like it's done the last 2 years and in the summer of 2010 and 2011, or worse, the European crisis explodes, or, you know, there's an attack on Iran, which drives up oil prices. We're back up to $4 and something cents at the pump. This is stuff that not even the best technology and money can overcome. So, like I said, this is going to be interesting to watch to see how this plays out. But right now, the one thing the president has going, he's got two things going against him. One, his own track record, and two, the economy is beginning to roll over again, as we've been reporting each week.
So how all of this plays out, this is almost like a drama unfolding as we watch it. We will find out in November what actually carries the sway. Will it be the high-tech glitz and the way that the president's going and using some of the new social media versus what Governor Romney may be doing in the more traditional vein? Or will the economy trump all of that? And that's going to remain to be seen. And of course, we'll cover it right here on Financial Sense. It's almost the mouse that roared the Greek elections this weekend that will affect, well, virtually the entire world's monetary system. Depends on which way they go, to stay with the euro and austerity or to return to the drachma. We'll find out after this weekend. And also planning for retirement. If you remember, we talked about annuities last week on the program. We got so much response, positive response from listeners, that we're starting a new thread, which we will pursue today and in future programs, our lifetime income, looking at the issues of people who are trying to retire and offering them scenarios and decisions they could make, pro or con. All of this coming up in the next hour of the Financial Sense News Hour at financialsense.com.